We're going to be reading this morning from Genesis chapter 40. Of course, the chapter divisions were not in the original text, but I think it's interesting nonetheless that this ended up being the 40th chapter of Genesis, because 40 is associated in the Bible with times of testing and purification of God's people, as the children of Israel were 40 years in the wilderness, and Moses himself was 40 years in the desert before he came to bring them out of Egypt. Jesus spent 40 days in the wilderness, fasting and being tempted by Satan. And the work of God, I believe, is a progressive work. It is one which goes through generations and continuously refines and perfects across multiple lives that which God is trying to bring forth. And I know that I read this passage from the New Testament with respect to the story of Jacob a few weeks ago, but I want to read it again. Actually, I want to read two short passages from James. You don't have to turn there. So that we can use those as a lens for reading the final chapter in the testing of Joseph. From James chapter 1, "My brethren, count it all joy when you fall into various trials, knowing that the testing of your faith produces patience. But let patience have its perfect work, that you may be perfect and complete, lacking nothing. If any of you lacks wisdom, let him ask of God, who gives to all liberally and without reproach, and it will be given to him." That's how the book of James starts. And as we noted when we read the story of Jacob, James actually is the Greek form of the Hebrew name Jacob. And James is the book which was addressed to the 12 tribes. So I think it's tied in pretty closely with the story of God's working in the tribes of Israel, who collectively are known as Israel, or Jacob. The story of Joseph being the son of Jacob is really an extension of Jacob's own story. As we saw at the beginning of the story of Joseph, it is introduced with, "This is the history of Jacob." So God took Jacob to a certain point, and then he starts the work with Joseph and takes him even further. I want to read also from James chapter 5. And this is very close to the end of the book of James. Starting in verse 7, "Therefore be patient, brethren, until the coming of the Lord. See how the farmer waits for the precious fruit of the earth, waiting patiently for it, until it receives the early and latter rain. You also be patient. Establish your hearts, for the coming of the Lord is at hand. Do not grumble against one another, brethren, lest you be condemned. Behold, the judge is standing at the door. My brethren, take the prophets who spoke in the name of the Lord as an example of suffering and patience. Indeed, we count them blessed to endure. You have heard of the perseverance of Job and seen the end intended by the Lord, that the Lord is very compassionate and merciful. But above all, my brethren, do not swear either by heaven or by earth or with any other oath, but let your yes be yes and your no, no, lest you fall into judgment. Is anyone among you suffering? Let him pray." So James teaches us what the proper response is to trials and what the Lord is accomplishing. You've heard the word patient and patience over and over again. Three times he says it in that last passage, and twice in the first one that I read. He says that patience is what the Lord is working in us. That word actually means a remaining under. We would use probably like the word undergo in English, but I think there's perhaps more to it than that even. Because it's possible to endure, that is to simply suffer trials, without really letting them work in your life in the way that God intends them to. There's various ways we can do that. You might wonder, for instance, why does James bring up this matter of swearing right in the middle of his talk about suffering trials and patience? It seems kind of out of place. But think about the circumstances under which people swear, very frequently when they're angry. or when they want to assert the truth of what they're saying. It is a way of attempting to invoke an authority that you do not have. It is a way of attempting to add power to the flesh. It's not acknowledging, I am a human being, I have limited knowledge, I have limited strength, I have no control over my circumstances, I can't change this that I'm in. That is humbling yourself. It is remaining under the trial. It's yielding to what God has allowed in your life and saying, I know this is for my good, I need to learn patience. So that is why I think, or one reason at least, that James includes it in this discussion, don't swear. Don't try to buttress the power of the flesh. Let the flesh die. Let those things be put to death in you that God has brought the trial to do. Don't resist it. Don't throw off the yoke. So what is the right response? In both the first passage and the last passage of James, he speaks to asking or praying. He says, if you lack, if you are in the midst of this trial and you find you don't have what you need to get through it, ask. God will give you what you need. He says, if you are afflicted, in the Old King James, or if you are suffering, pray. That's the heart that is being shaped by the trial. The heart that's remaining under it, being humbled, and simply asking, Lord, I can't take this. I don't understand this. I don't know what I'm supposed to do. Ask, and you'll be given the grace that you need. He said, my grace is sufficient. So thinking about the story of Joseph, you could just plot the graph of his life, and it seems like it starts out pretty good. He is the son of Jacob's favorite wife. He's loved by his father. He has dreams that predict that he's going to be the ruler. But down it goes as his brethren hate him, sell him into slavery. Then it ticks up a little bit. He's favored by Potiphar. He's put in charge of Potiphar's household. Things are looking up. Then he's lied about and slandered and thrown into prison down to the bottom again. We don't actually know how long he was in the prison between the end of chapter 39 and the beginning of chapter 40. It was probably a period of some years. And one can imagine that he prayed continuously. And one can imagine that he didn't understand why this was happening to him. He kept making the right choices and getting the wrong result. And it's easy to imagine that he could have been very tempted to simply say, well, this program is not working. I'm doing everything that I'm supposed to be doing. I'm obeying the commandments of God, and I'm suffering. Every time I speak the truth, every time I do what's right, someone lies about me, someone is jealous of me, and I end up worse off than I was before. I think I'll just do it my own way and see if I can improve my situation. But that's not what Joseph did. And the fact that that's not what he did shows that Joseph was making the right choices. He was remaining under the trial that God allowed in his life. So, as we read this, I want to look at four different, I'm going to call them graces, but you could also call them fruits of the Spirit, that are observable in Joseph's life through this story. The things that God wants to work in our lives as he takes us through trials, as he refines us. The Old Testament word for a trial speaks to the refining of metals, where the metal worker turns up the heat on the crucible and the impurities rise to the surface and he skims them off and does it again and again. The psalmist alludes to the words of the Lord in this context as silver tried in a furnace of earth purified seven times. So you may think the first time, well, that's gone. We're done. We're pure. God knows. He knows exactly how much is needed. Someone has said that the goldsmith knows the gold is pure when he can see his own face reflected in it. I don't know if that's true or not, but it's a very good picture because it is the face of Jesus Christ that the Father's looking for in our lives. So in Genesis chapter 40, it came to pass after these things that the butler and the baker of the king of Egypt offended their lord, the king of Egypt. And Pharaoh was angry with his two officers, the chief butler and the chief baker. So he put them in custody in the house of the captain of the guard, in the prison, the place where Joseph was confined. And the captain of the guard charged Joseph with them, and he served them. So they were in custody for a while. The first grace that we can see in Joseph's life is the grace of humility. It is very easy when you have very little to hold on to it tightly. All that Joseph had at this point in his life was the fact that he was in charge of the prison. And some people in that circumstance would get what pleasure they could out of ruling over other people in that context. I'm in charge around here, and make sure you know about it. But the scripture says that when the captain of the guard charged Joseph with them, he served them. This is what the Lord, one of the things that the Lord is doing when he takes us through trials, is he is teaching us to be humble. He is not going to use someone to lead others that is going to misrepresent him by lording it over them, by pushing themselves. The flesh has to be put down and die, lest God should be misrepresented. And so Joseph did not use his small authority to buttress himself, but to serve those that he was charged with. And that is indeed what Jesus said that we should do in his kingdom. Whichever of us desires a position of leadership should become the least and serve. He said, follow my example. I washed your feet. He did not come down here to give orders, but to serve and to do what was best for us, to give himself for us. Then the butler and the baker of the king of Egypt, who were confined in the prison, had a dream, both of them each man's dream in one night, and each man's dream with its own interpretation. And Joseph came into them in the morning and looked at them, and saw that they were sad. So he asked Pharaoh's officers who were with him in the custody of his lord's house, saying, why do you look so sad today? The second grace that we can observe in Joseph's life through this story is that of compassion. Of course, we heard a lot about compassion, I guess it was last week, in Jason's teaching, for which I was thankful. I believe that one of the definitions of compassion, or going off the etymology, would be to suffer with someone. But most people who are suffering, their minds are taken up with their own problems. I know that this is the way I usually am. If I am in the middle of a serious problem, I don't want someone else bringing me their problem. Like, you're going to have to solve that yourself, because I'm really busy right now. And Joseph could easily have been bitter. He could have easily been self-absorbed. He could have easily had that attitude of, everybody in the prison is sad. Everybody in the prison has got troubles. Why bother to ask someone, oh, you look sad, let me hear what's bothering you? Suffering the right way, remaining under the trial, and seeking and receiving God's grace gives us the grace of compassion. Paul says that we're able to comfort others with the same comfort that we've received from God. And that grace comes to the lowly. It comes to those who humble themselves. So humility is first. We humble ourselves. We receive grace. And then we can share that grace with others. We have the capacity, because we have endured suffering, to minister to those who are also suffering. So we receive the grace first, and then we're able to care about other people, not to be so occupied with our own problems that we don't have any time for them. And Joseph was very proactive about that. He did not even wait for these men to come to him and say, hey, we've got a problem. He just saw their expressions and said, you look sad. why don't you tell me what's wrong? And they said to him, we each have had a dream, and there is no interpreter of it. So Joseph said to them, do not interpretations belong to God? Tell them to me, please. The third grace that I wanted to highlight here in Joseph's life, we can call piety. That is a word, unfortunately, that has gotten a very bad rap because it is generally associated with hypocrisy. So much so that if you call someone pious, it's like a pejorative. Oh, he's so pious. But scripturally, I believe that what it means is simply the fear of God. That is a right reverence for God. And one could imagine that these men were probably fairly important prior to their being cast in prison, of course. I have heard that historically, the king's personal servants, even those who performed very menial tasks, but who were in his presence continually, sometimes had more influence over him than his political appointees, that is, his ministers who ran the government, because the ones who were close to him personally had access all the time, and sometimes they would even control the access of other people. So it wasn't just being a butler or being a baker, you would have access to the king. And Joseph might have been thinking about that. And if he knew, as he apparently did at this point, that he had a gift for interpreting dreams, he might have said, what do you mean there's no interpreter? I'm an interpreter. Just tell me. I would assume that it was pretty common in the Egyptian court for there to be people on hand who would interpret dreams. Dreams are still, even today, considered very important in Middle Eastern culture. There's books written on how to properly interpret them. And these men seem to have an expectation that had they been in their ordinary environs, their dreams would have been interpreted by someone. But here they are in the prison, there's no interpreter. Well, Joseph, I mean, this is like ready-made opportunity. You're looking for an interpreter? I'm your man. What did he say? Do not interpretations belong to God? He did not take the opportunity to point to himself. The thing that came out of his heart was, God is the one who has the answer to your problem. I don't have the answer to your problem. And this is another thing that trials work in us. Is we understand through trials that everything good comes from God, that God has all the answers, that God has the grace, that God has the revelation and the wisdom. We ask and we receive it from him. We have our confidence in the flesh destroyed so that we don't say to anyone, I've got the answer, just ask me the question. I've been very guilty of this in my life. I mean guilty of the wrong side of this, which is just wanting, being so full of answers and sometimes even giving answers when the question hasn't been asked. The Lord wants to take that away so that he can make us a channel of his wisdom, his revelation, his answers for people. Because he knows the time in which they need it. So he says, do not interpretations belong to God? Tell them to me, please. Then the chief butler told his dream to Joseph and said to him, behold, in my dream, a vine was before me. And in the vine were three branches. It was as though it budded. Its blossoms shot forth, and its clusters brought forth ripe grapes. Then Pharaoh's cup was in my hand, and I took the grapes and pressed them into Pharaoh's cup and placed the cup in Pharaoh's hand. And Joseph said to him, this is the interpretation of it. The three branches are 3 days. Now within 3 days, Pharaoh will lift up your head and restore you to your place, and you will put Pharaoh's cup in his hand according to the former manner when you were his butler. But remember me when it is well with you, and please show kindness to me, make mention of me to Pharaoh, and get me out of this house. For indeed I was stolen away from the land of the Hebrews, and also I have done nothing here that they should put me into the dungeon. I think this shows a little bit of weakness on Joseph's part, very understandable. I mean, who wouldn't under those circumstances? He knows this guy's getting out. He knows he's going right back into Pharaoh's presence. And you can say, well, this is God's provision. But there's something in the language here that bothers me a bit. with regard to what is it possible, and I think it is possible, that Joseph was looking to this man just a bit. And I think that that's one of the reasons, as we'll see at the end of the story, he didn't get out right away. God still had more to work in him. Because our hope is not in man. Because men will always fail. If your confidence in yourself has been destroyed, then one natural reaction is to look for someone else to have confidence in. Well, if I can't rely on myself, maybe I can rely on someone else. Maybe I can find some charismatic leader or preacher or pastor or teacher or someone that I can just be a follower. Maybe someone out there has the answers for me and I can just ask them and they'll tell me, or I can have a connection. The only connection we need is the connection with God. God could open that door for Joseph any time he chose to do so. Now, in the end, he did use the butler, as we know from the story. But it wasn't the butler who got Joseph out of the prison house. It was God. And God did it in God's time. So we don't look to man. We remain under the circumstance that God has allowed in our lives to teach us and to form these graces in us. When the chief baker saw that the interpretation was good, he said to Joseph, "I also was in my dream, and there were three white baskets on my head. In the uppermost basket were all kinds of baked goods for Pharaoh, and the birds ate them out of the basket on my head." So Joseph answered and said, "This is the interpretation of it. The three baskets are 3 days. Within 3 days, Pharaoh will lift off your head from you and hang you on a tree, and the birds will eat your flesh from you." And this, although it might not immediately be apparent, is also a work of grace, and that is the grace of faithfulness. Joseph was not a flatterer. He did not tell people what they wanted to hear. I am sort of reading between the lines here, but I'm thinking that the baker initially did not want to hear the interpretation of his dream. The butler was the first one to give his dream to Joseph, and it says, when the chief baker saw that the interpretation was good, he said to Joseph. So that would say to me that he only wanted the answer if it was the answer he wanted. Otherwise, he didn't really want to know. And we're going to be confronted with these situations sometimes. We're going to be asked questions of by people who only have one answer that they consider acceptable. And we will have to be dead to self enough to be faithful to them, to speak the truth to them, even if the truth is not really what they want, even if it brings evil consequences on us. The expression "shoot the messenger" was not made up out of thin air. That actually did happen in the ancient world. People who brought bad news from battle were sometimes killed. Being in the prison with someone that you've just told you're going to die in 3 days might not be terribly good for your health. It might have been a lot easier to say, "Well, I really can't come up with anything from that one. I'm sorry. My wisdom fails me." But he spoke the truth to this man, and it was not simply to his destruction. He had 3 days to think about the fact that he was going to die. If he believed Joseph, now maybe he didn't. Scripture doesn't tell us if either of them believed him. But he had the word from the Lord, so he was warned. He knew what his end was going to be. And so he had the opportunity to repent. He wouldn't have had that if Joseph had refused to tell him the truth. So this is something else that God is forming in us. Humility, compassion, piety, faithfulness. Just briefly, I wanted to also look at a bit of a... I can't help seeing these things, and I think in almost all the Old Testament, perhaps in every chapter, you could find something that pointed to Jesus. I think there may be more than one interpretation, in fact, of these dreams. They were immediately relevant to the men to whom they were given. But these two men actually remind me nothing so much as the thieves who were crucified with Jesus, because to one Jesus said, this day you'll be with me in paradise, and the other presumably was lost. So to the butler, the dream was given in which he pressed the grapes that came from the vine into Pharaoh's cup and presented the cup to Pharaoh. And this puts me in mind of Jesus Christ coming from the vine, which most often in Scripture is Israel, and being crushed for our iniquities. That is, it was our sin that crushed him, and his blood was poured out on our behalf. And that is what we present before God, and that's what makes us acceptable to him. In the baker's dream, it's perhaps a little bit more difficult to unpack, but I did notice that in the dream, he says, there were three white baskets on my head, and the uppermost basket were all kinds of baked goods for Pharaoh. I'm sort of wondering what was in the other two baskets. He was, after all, Pharaoh's baker. And perhaps what got him into the dungeon in the first place was a certain amount of malfeasance, and Pharaoh was only getting part of the proceeds of his work. But this is also very typical of those who try to please God in the flesh. We'll put God's basket on top with the stuff that we've reserved for him. And the other two baskets, we just hope he won't notice, because those will be underneath. That doesn't work. And most often it results in it becoming quite obvious that none of it was really given to God, not with a right heart. And that's why we find in the dream the birds coming and eating the bread out of the basket. God doesn't accept that sacrifice. God doesn't accept, well, I'll give you a portion and the rest I save for myself. And the birds of the air in Jesus' parable of the sower came and devoured up the seed that fell on stony ground, which is an unbelieving heart. So there we can see, I think, a couple of things that point forward. Now it came to pass on the third day, which was Pharaoh's birthday, that he made a feast for all his servants, and he lifted up the head of the chief butler and of the chief baker among his servants. Then he restored the chief butler to his butlership again, and he placed the cup in Pharaoh's hand, but he hanged the chief baker as Joseph had interpreted to them. And then, of course, the story ended happily. The chief butler was so thankful for what Joseph did that he immediately took his request to the king. Joseph was let out of the prison. The end. Yet, the chief butler did not remember Joseph, but forgot him. It's kind of hard to believe, really. And I have to think that for the chief butler to actually forget, of course the human heart is full of ingratitude, but I'm suspicious that it was actually God who made him forget. Because, as we saw previously, there may have been something in Joseph that was sort of looking to him as, hey, you could be my inside guy, you could be my ticket out of here. And you can just imagine, on that line that grafts Joseph's life, here he goes up again. He's got just this much hope of a way to get out of this prison. And bong, down to the bottom. 2 years. He sat there waiting for something to happen. I mean, his prophecy came true. This guy went to the presence of the king of Egypt. Nothing happened. He forgot him. What position of greater despair could you have? Kidnapped from your family, made a slave, falsely accused, slandered, thrown in prison, finally get a chance to maybe get out, and the guy forgets him. We generally look at stuff like this and say, that is totally not fair. in someone else's life, let alone our own lives. And we'll, most of us will never go through anything like what Joseph went through. But the trial of your faith produces patience. God has a purpose. He has a reason. And you're going to go through it anyway, so you might as well profit by it. You might as well remain under it. You might as well learn patience. Because you can resist it. You can have the opposite of all these in your life. You can have pride and bitterness and a lack of the fear of God. And you can be a flatterer. It's not necessarily going to help. Much of the time, you may even suffer more. And you suffer without the grace of God, because His grace goes to the humble. And if you keep humbling yourself, eventually we'll be exalted. The right answer is always to keep going lower. And you might think, well, I went low enough. I humbled myself enough. The fact that you have that thought, the fact that I have that thought, shows that we have not. If we get to the point and we say, why is God requiring this of me? I did this already. No, you didn't. Obviously you didn't. Because if you had, there wouldn't be anything there to say it. There wouldn't be anything left of the flesh to say, I deserve better. Because the flesh would be dead. So this is what the Lord wants out of us. And remember what James said, you have seen the end intended by the Lord, that He is full of mercy and compassion. It does not please Him to see us put down in the dungeon, like, that's where you belong, just stay there. That's not what the Lord has in mind. And we're going to see what He had in mind for Joseph. It was fabulous. But He couldn't go straight to it. We can't go straight to the throne. There are things that must be passed through before God. There is patience that must be learned. There's humility that must be learned in those things if we allow God to use the trials that He has ordained in our lives to shape us into the image of Jesus.